And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And this is the second portion of the evening where I talk with an author. And tonight's author is Paul Rademacher. And he is the author of A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, Travel Tips for the Spiritually Perplexed. I love the name. And it was a great book to read and understand the journey. So welcome, Paul.
Well, thank you, Laurie. It's wonderful to be with you.
Mm-hmm. So your book mostly is about your journey, and I usually typically start with that. But is there any defining moments that you feel sort of started you on this journey or kind of got you to where you are right now?
Well, I think the really defining moment for me was when, I think this was back in 1981, my brother and I had a construction company, and we were working up on the roof of a house one day, and I noticed that there was something that was a little bit out of alignment, so I was kind of pulling on a board to straighten it out, and all of a sudden the board gave way, and I found myself careening off the roof of the home, and I fell about 9 feet, but I fell very awkwardly, and I didn't have a chance to adjust for the fall. Ended up landing on a pile of gravel and fracturing my left hip, although at the time I didn't know it was fractured. We had a crane there that was helping us to lift things up onto the roof, and I missed the base of the crane by about 6 inches with my head, which was fortunate.
Yeah.
But they took me to the hospital in an ambulance, and when I got there, they did some x-rays and didn't find anything wrong with the hip. And so they put me in physical therapy, which, you know, if you do happen to have a fractured hip, is probably not the place you want to end up.
No.
So the doctor could see that I was struggling pretty bad, and so he came by and he said, let's take another look at that hip. And so they did some more x-rays and found out that there was, in fact, a fracture there. So they took me out of physical therapy and put me into traction. And when the doctor came by and said that I was going to be off work for a number of weeks, I found myself going into this spiral downward. It was a spiral of pain and anxiety, pain because the hip was excruciating, and anxiety because this was the busiest time of our construction year, and there was no way I could possibly be off work, and I was convinced that my brother couldn't run the company without my help. And so as I was going down, and it wasn't really even much, it wasn't like it was a metaphor. I could actually feel myself spiraling in this downward path. And then, without warning, all of a sudden, I broke through into another reality. And in that other world, that other dimension, the pain that I had felt in the hip completely dissipated. The anxiety went away completely. And I found myself surrounded by total peace. There is a passage in the Bible that talks about the peace that passes all understanding. And for me, that was a real place. It wasn't a metaphor. I've been to that environment, and when I was there, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was no such thing as an accident. Everything had meaning and purpose, and I was surrounded by total love. And then at some point in that experience, and I say some point because it's very difficult to understand the dimensions of time when you move into these kinds of realms. At some point, I found myself standing in front of a being of light, and we are conversing about my life, but we're not using words. And to this day, I don't really remember what was said in that conversation, but I knew that it was profoundly important to me. So when I came out of that experience, it was like, wow, that was amazing, because I didn't know something like that was possible. I hadn't been meditating or studying this. It was just something I literally fell into. But prior to that time, I had been wrestling with a question. I thought, should I or should I not go to seminary? And when I had that experience, I decided that that was clearly the voice of God that was speaking. And so I went off to seminary with my wife and 2 children, and 3 years later graduated from Princeton Theological Seminary with a Master of Divinity degree. And I thought for some time that experience of falling off the roof was specifically to answer the question about the call into the ministry. But what I realized over time was that there was something much, much deeper that was happening there. And that was that it created a hunger that I wanted so much to get back to that world again, to learn about it, to experience it, to learn to integrate it more with my life. And really what happened at that point was that I think it became my life's work. and has propelled me on a path that has led me to where I am today in this position working with the Monroe Institute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you've had some profound experience as well on your journey, and certainly we will discuss a few of them today. Mm-hmm. There was also a point where you were hitchhiking and you were observing as an almost near-death experience happened to you, and that seemed to also be a profound impact on you.
Yes, that was actually happened before I fell off of the roof.
Right.
And that experience was a bit of a different category. When I fell off the roof, that was an experience of a non-physical kind of domain. But the experience you're talking about when I was hitchhiking happened when I was in my early 20s. And at that time in my life, for some reason, I had this motto that went, you know, if it scares you, you should do it. You know, I think I was young and I wanted adventure, and somehow I figured that sooner or later it was going to be something that was going to, I'm going to have to encounter fear along the way. And so that was a good marker for me. And one of the things that really frightened me was the idea of hitchhiking. And I think it was because when you're hitchhiking, you really have no control over what's going to happen to you. You have no idea who's going to pick you up, really where you're going to end up, or even if you're going to get there, and what condition you're going to be once you arrive. And so you're at the mercy of all of the elements. Well, it just so happened that my sister was moving from Ohio in the United States to Tucson, Arizona, and she needed somebody to help her move. So I thought, this is a great experience for me. I'll help her move, and then I will hitchhike back to my home in Pennsylvania. But I decided I'd never been on to the west coast of the United States, so rather than going back east right away, I decided I'd head west and then go up through California and then back to Pennsylvania. Well, at one point in the journey, I was picked up by a trucker, and it turned out that he was one of the original Hell's Angels. And, you know, it was really fascinating to me because I was just this very naive young guy, and here I am hooked up in this truck cab with this total stranger. But he and I hit it off right away, and he's just had all kinds of stories to tell me. But inevitably, there came a point where we had to separate, and he dropped me off in Big Sur, California. And if you've never been to Big Sur, it's a place where there are these huge redwoods that just stretch up into the mm-hmm. sky. And when he dropped me off, there was this immediate sense of loneliness because I really enjoyed his company. And also an immediate sense of danger, too, because in that part of California, once the sun sets, it gets very cold very fast. Mm-hmm. So here I am. I'm standing on the side of the road, and you know, cars are passing me by every once in a while, but mostly it's just really quiet. And I started to get scared because I didn't know where I was going to spend the night, and certainly I wasn't equipped for the cold weather. And so as the sun is just starting to come down in the sky, I could see the shafts of light as they were streaking down through the leaves of these redwoods. And here I am at the greatest moment of vulnerability in my life, and all of a sudden, the scene shifted. It took on a different quality altogether. The environment was still there, but the redwoods seemed like they came to life, and there was a spiritual essence that started to communicate with me that sort of came from the earth itself. And the normal dividing line between who I was and the world around me started to disintegrate, and there was a feeling of oneness and unity and a spiritual essence. And the sense of greatest safety I've ever experienced in my life, which was so ironic because here I was again in this moment of extreme vulnerability, and yet I felt completely, totally safe, which turned out to be rather prophetic because after that experience, I'm still standing there, and a young woman picked me up in her car, and we started up north on Highway 1. Highway 1 weaves in and out and virtually hangs from the edge of the mountains. And so as you're driving along, the mountains are a sheer vertical up to the sky, and then off to the left, just drops off into the ocean. And we were coming around a bend in the road, and the sun was setting right at the horizon, and suddenly it blinded us as we were coming around the bend. And right there in the middle of the road was a huge boulder that had just fallen down from the mountain on the right. We hit that boulder, and the car started flipping, and I could just feel the whole world revolving around the axis of that car. And I knew in that moment that obviously we were going to go over the edge and I was going to die, and there was just no doubt about that. And as the car was rolling, I was really struck by how calm I was. It was almost as if that sense of protection and nurture that I felt back in the Redwoods was still with me. And I had a sense that everything, it didn't matter that I was going to die. It was just an interesting thing that was happening, almost as if there was some kind of an old wisdom within me that had seen death many, many times, and this was no big deal. This is just another way to die. But to my complete surprise, the car rolled over three times, but it rolled down straight down the road, and we ended up upside down, and we scrambled out of the car. And right across the street was a guy in a motorhome who took us in and cared for us. And he then took me all the way from California back to Minnesota. And along the way, he was a gourmet cook, and he was cooking up all kinds of wonderful food for us. And so I just happened to land with him out of this accident. And it was just another short ride back to Pennsylvania from there. And so it was one of those experiences that you never forget, and my first encounter with the fact that there is true protection in this world.
Yeah. And, you've had some very interesting experiences. I mean, these are two very profound impacts on your life. And you did go into the seminary, and you did, you were a minister for a while, and... Mm-hmm. And I think, like all of us, we, especially these times, you have gone through, some dark nights, and you've acknowledged the duality, and you've seen the split that we have, the separation that we have when we separate, when our ego seems to want to separate from God, and we feel this incredible loneliness when we're seeking something, but we're seeking outside of ourselves instead of within ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's a really important thing that many, many people overlook. And that's that there's an indicator, I think, that we carry within us that there is more to this world than we often want to admit or that we have been taught. And it is this longing that so many people feel. When we feel it, our natural tendency is to want to get rid of it or to cover it up or to get busy so we won't feel that and so we can just ignore it. But I think that sense of longing for something more is really crucial, because it's an indication that we know somehow deep in our psyche that something is missing, and it's that sense of something missing that is the beginning of the journey so that we can begin to understand more completely the fact that this world is filled with much more than meets the eye. The two experiences that I told you, I think, begin to tap into those two domains that I think often are missing. And that's the first of all, that this physical world contains a sort of magic or wonder or mystery or spirit. And also there is the non-physical domain, that world that lies beyond the five physical senses, that also contains magic and wonder and mystery and is filled with all kinds of experiences for us to explore. When we start into those, propelled by our longing, propelled by our desire, then I think we touch a much more profound sense of what it means to be human. And so some of that longing that comes from the split that we feel starts to, the holes start to fill in a little bit, and we have a much greater sense of who we are. and also, I think, a much more profound sense of our sense of purpose in life.
Right. And you kind of had to go dealing with, you know, going into the seminary, dealing with your connection with God and the deception that sort of, I guess, divides us, that splits us between, you know, the truth and having that, those spiritual experiences and having the broader religious perspective, the splits that can happen in there, and then you tie them all together in a way that, you know, that often the Bible or church doesn't do for us, but you find that way to sort of bridge spirituality with religion where often it's not done.
Right. Yeah, what I'm doing in the book is looking at this issue of, first of all, that you talk about the split that I think is sort of at the fundamental underpinnings of the issue. And, you know, when I look at, for instance, the book of Genesis, and I look at the creation story, what I find really fascinating in that is that it's not really so much a creation story as it is a story of a series of separations, that there is this divine being that looks on this the chaos and says, well, I'm going to create light. God separates the light from the darkness, and then there's the light from the day and versus the light from the night, the heavens above from the earth below, and the earth is separated from the seas and the various animals, and then the final separation is the one in the creation of the human beings, which is the separation between male and female. And at each one of those separations, the text says that God looks upon it and says that it is good. But then when all of the separations are viewed in their totality, God says that they are very good. You know, so there's this sense that even with the separations, there is no idea that one part of the separation is good and the other part is evil, which I think then really sets up the next story, which is about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and they're told that there's only one tree that they cannot eat of, and that is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They can eat of everything else. So there's been a lot of speculation. What was that tree? What was that tree all about? Some people say it was sex. Some people would say it's disobedience and blah, blah, blah. I think it's just what it says. It's the knowledge of good and evil. And when we look upon this world in all of its goodness, and it was that world that I encountered when I was in Big Sur and the redwoods came alive for me, when we see it with those kinds of mystical eyes, then there's no such thing as good and evil. Everything just is. But we have a propensity to want to look at it and say, well, I like this and I don't like that, and this is good and that's bad, and we always tend to do it on the basis of what is advantageous to us personally. And so I think we have a very skewed view of creation. And so then what we do with our judgments is we split it in two, good and evil. And so we don't see the real spiritual essence that underlies the whole thing. And we take this state of the Eden consciousness and we get kicked out of the garden. And then we're faced with moving through life in this very laborious way that is very often very painful. But I think that underneath every religious tradition, you have this encounter with oneness, this encounter with the mystical world. And if you look at them, you know, they are filled with these people who have traveled to other dimensions or have had this shift in awareness or consciousness, and then are faced with the task of trying to come back and tell people who want to listen what they have experienced. And I think it's that mystical domain, that mystical experience that lies at the basis of every religion, and that's what all the religions hold in common. And from my perspective, that's the one thing that really holds the prospect for peace in the world, because once you move into that realm, then you're looking at the things that we share and that we hold in common and that we see as one rather than the things that divide us. And I think that's why this study of human consciousness is so powerful and so crucial for the world today.
Most definitely. You talk about the mystic. You had some mystic experiences. You've had, you know, I don't know whether people, you know the definition necessarily of mystic versus spiritual versus religion. You've had, you know, some very mystic experiences. Mm-hmm. We've, you know, those of us that seek, you know, the one question that keeps coming up is, you know, why do you think the spiritual journey is so difficult?
Well, I think it's difficult in our age because we simply, for many generations, or at least in the Western culture and with the industrialized societies, you know, we haven't really been taught very much about it. And so we have this scientific worldview that has served us very well for a number of centuries. It has really helped us to explore the physical domain. But there are some built-in biases in that serve to sort of shield our understanding and our awareness. One of them, and I think probably one of the primary one, is the idea that the only legitimate area of inquiry is to explore the physical world. Mm. There is no non-physical dimension, often from the scientific perspective, and I think that goes back to when science was emerging and it was in conflict with the church. There was sort of a truce that was made that the church said, well, we'll handle spiritual things and science, you're confined just to the physical world. But what has happened over time is that bias has crept into our culture. And so we operate primarily from our concern about survival in the physical world. That tends to dominate everything that we do. And so when you look at your typical day, the vast majority of your time is spent on meeting the needs of the body, whether that's at work, earning enough money so that then we can feed and clothe and shelter ourselves, or just finding the comforts of our body in different fashions, the way we spend our time in front of the TV. So our time is really taken up with other pursuits. And so we have lost the ability to connect with the spiritual world, a spiritual world that has been there all along, has been there from the beginning, and has been celebrated by indigenous cultures from the beginning. But we simply have lost touch with that. And so when we start into it, we really don't have much of a context that we can use for our explorations, and so it doesn't make sense, and so we'll often push it away rather than embracing it.
Yeah, clearly. You talk about, you know, the fear factor and how, you know, and you just really talked about it right now as well, is that, you know, we're so bent on survival that we, you know, this internal melodrama that we have and where we're feeling so separate and alone, and we're not knowing really how to bridge that, to, you know, to get out of the survival, you know, how do you, you know, some people say that that's, you know, part of why so many of the institutions are about controlling us through fear so that we don't get into the power of the spiritual evolution or our own, you know, our own consciousness. And I don't know, I think truly it's really about us, you know, because there is separation within us, because we are not in oneness, everything outside of us has to reflect that anyway. So is it, you know, one causing the other, or is it because we are feeling separate that we're not experiencing the oneness?
Well, you know, I think that one of the biggest issues that we face, and I think you touched on it very eloquently there, is this issue of fear. We live in a very fearful culture in a very fearful time, and there are many people who have capitalized on that fear, and so we, it becomes part and parcel of our existence. I think one of the biggest tasks that we have is to reject that, and to say, wait a minute, that, you know, I there's nothing that I have to fear. When you start into this spiritual path. Just as I found out again when I was on the roadside in Big Sur, California, there really is a nurture that undergirds all of reality. And I think another aspect to the fear is this fear of death. And when we are preoccupied with the idea that we are nothing more than our physical bodies, then death becomes the ultimate thing we have to resist. Mm. Because we're convinced at some deep level that if the physical body expires, then we're going to expire with it. But when you move into the spiritual path and you start to move into the experience of life that is larger than the physical body, then that changes the way you look at death. And you realize, hey, wait a minute, I've got something that continues to exist long after the physical body drops away. So what is that something, and what is the nature of it? When you start asking those kinds of questions, then it moves you away from this preoccupation with fear and survival. And you start asking questions like, well, what should I be doing with this life? Who am I? You know, that's the perennial question is, the perennial advice was know thyself. And that's really key, because once you start to look at that, then you start to ask, well, if I'm more than my physical body, then how big am I? What are my dimensions? What are my limitations? And that's an entirely different conversation from the one of survival and fear.
Mm-hmm. And you talk a little bit about how, you know, we have a greater belief in the power of evil or the power of the devil mm-hmm. than we do God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find this so fascinating because, you know, I think if people had to make a choice between their faith in the devil and their faith in God, I think there's a large portion of people who would choose their faith in the devil. I'm not sure why that is, except to say that maybe the devil's just simply more fascinating for a lot of people. And the real advantage to belief in the devil and the belief in evil is that it absolves you from having to look within. Because you can always look outside and be convinced that the devil is lurking underneath every rock and behind every tree. And if that's the case, then your real task is to not only to resist the devil, but to fight the devil. And that's a very kind of interesting journey that can be very preoccupying for people. But it also distracts us from the real interior work that we need to be doing. Because from my perspective, you know, the devil isn't out there. The devil is this struggle that we feel is an interior struggle. There's a wonderful quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn where he says something like, the dividing line between good and evil cuts through every human heart. And who wants to destroy a piece of their own heart? Mm-hmm. And when you realize that the people outside of you are just mirrors for what's going on in your own interior world, then that calls you to a really profound inner work to look at what is your impact on the world, what are your relationships like. And once again, that pulls you back to the question or the task of knowing yourself. And that's the really profound work that I think we're called to do in this world.
Right. Hmm. You talk a little bit about, and I think we sort of mentioned it almost in the sense, but you talk about being authentic and, you know, being in your grief. And there's a lot of talk these days about, you know, shame and how shame may be one of the, you know, the biggest blocks in our separation. And I think, you know, you can definitely bring it back to the Garden of Eden, where we feel we did something wrong. And, you know, we just don't realize that every judgment we make, every time we make a judgment about what's good and what's evil, is separating us out. Like we tend to not be aware enough of the pain that causes ourselves. And yet we aren't in a place of forgiveness yet, because we're trying to blame something else for it instead of bringing in our own authenticity of what we're actually feeling, which is this shame or this grief of what we've done or what has been done or how we're keeping ourselves separate because we're not even aware consciously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a real struggle that so many of us face, you know, day in and day out. And part of the issue is that, you know, we can look at these things from an intellectual perspective. You know, we can talk about ideas like unconditional love. And perhaps there are times when we can even begin to extend that unconditional love to other people. But when it comes to extending that unconditional love to ourselves, we somehow fall short. And the shame that we carry with us simply will not allow us to think of ourselves as being worthy of that. But I think that's where experience brings a different category of knowing to this whole issue. If you're talking about it from an intellectual perspective, that always stays up in the head. But when you have an experience of unconditional love, when you are surrounded by, total peace, and you know that it is something that you couldn't make up, that it is something that you've just somehow fallen into or that you've woken up to, that so many people talk about, that it is part of the spiritual path. When you have that encounter, then that begins to change things, not just from an intellectual perspective, but more from a heart level and more from a knowing level, because you know that you are not just an individual separate. You know that you are one with all of creation, and that all of creation is undergirded by this extraordinary energy that we call love, simply because we have no better word for it than that. So when that happens, that is can be kind of a profound life-changing event that can start to get at some of the shame and guilt that we carry. And then as you begin to extend that on behalf of other people, it seems to reinforce that at some very core level. So I see that as a really key component to this whole mystical, spiritual journey that we're on.
Mm-hmm. And how do we get from that place of, you know, getting it from our intellect, out of our intellect and into our heart?
Well, it can happen any number of ways, really. There have been, since the beginning of time, all kinds of different techniques for practicing the spiritual journey. And, you know, from meditation to chanting to dance to drumming to spiritual direction, I think the first aspect of that has to do, though, with listening, as I said before, with the longing that one has. Not pushing that away, but embracing that, turning toward it, and beginning to interact with it in such a way that it begins to become a teacher for you. And each of us has a certain path, I think, that we're called to in this world. And the path, that first step, begins with paying attention to that deep longing of the heart, and then being able to make time for it. Purposefully carving out a time in your life when you can pursue that with gusto. That might be carving out a time of meditation every day. It might be following the passion that you feel in your heart that is so compelling. But I think one of the easiest ways to do that is to maybe go to a conference or a seminar where there's a lot of emphasis on silence rather than talking, a lot of emphasis on experiencing the inner world rather than conversing about it. And I think that's really key. It's the experience that is so important. And I think that's why the work that we do at the Monroe Institute is really profound, because that's our emphasis here. We have 6-day programs where people can come and they can begin to experience what it means to move into these altered states of consciousness, these altered states of awareness. And we have a particular technology that uses sound to help people to move relatively quickly into states of awareness and states of consciousness that would usually take years and years, perhaps even decades of meditation and practice to achieve otherwise. So the work that we do and other people are doing as well, I think, provides an avenue of entree into this world that maybe we haven't had in the past, and I think is pretty appropriate for our time. Mm-hmm. And so in the work that we do here, we get to see people going through these profound changes in 6 days, to the point where they, you know, they will tell us things like, this has been the most important week of my life, or my life has been changed completely because of what's happened here. And again, it's because of the ability to move into these realms experientially rather than through philosophy or speculation or through dogma.
Right. And that was an important part of your journey, and you call it the lifting of the veil when you went to the Monroe Institute. Now, you know, you were able to pierce time with regards to an experience you had about your father. That's kind of profound. Why don't we talk about that?
Sure. And that was that was one of those that was so moving to me at so many different levels. My father had Alzheimer's disease for about 12 or 13 years before he finally died. And so, you know, that's a really tough illness to witness, because he was a pretty brilliant guy, and to watch him wasting away like that, to the point where in the last days there were many times when he didn't know who I was really, really difficult to watch, and traumatic at many levels. On the night that he died, I was at his bedside, and had a sense that maybe this was about the end of things, and he would sort of weave in and out of consciousness, and even when he was conscious, he wasn't really all that aware. But every once in a while, there would be this just a moment of clarity, and I happened to catch him in one of those moments of clarity, and I said to him, Dad, listen, when you get to the other side, will you come back and tell me what it's all about? He didn't say anything, but there was just this little bit of a slight nod, as if he understood what I was saying, and that he was going to try his best to make that happen. Well, when I came to the Monroe Institute 7 years after that, I should probably give you a little bit of background about what we do here.
Absolutely.
And so that you understand better what these comments are all about. We have a sound technology. We use sound waves to help people to move into different states of awareness. We do this by having them lie down in a bed that is surrounded by four walls so that you can keep the outside distractions to a minimum. And we put headphones on, and then we go through various exercises that help people to progressively and gently move into deeper and deeper states. And we also have exercise here, and people can get a massage. And one of the things I did was I got a massage, and in the middle of that massage, I had this really strong sense that my father, who had died 7 years before, was a part of that massage for some reason. I could almost see his hands and his arms, because they looked so much like my own. And here he was in the midst of this thing, completely by surprise. Well, we went into an experience after that, and the work here had its beginnings in Bob Monroe and got known for out-of-body experience, and that's only part of what we do. But what I'm going to tell you sounds as if I had an out-of-body experience, and I guess maybe you could classify it as that. So I'm in this exercise and just sort of moving along through this environment or space. I can't even tell you what it is, but there's a sense of movement. And all of a sudden, off to my left, I see this circle, and they are beings of light. And there is something that they're looking at the bottom of this circle. And I thought, oh my goodness, look at that. Those are people of light. You just don't see that every day. So I stopped and I went over to them. And I looked over the shoulder of one of these beings, and I could see that there was this person lying there in the midst of their circle. And I was absolutely shocked to realize that it was my father, who obviously had just come over from being dead and had arrived in this afterlife reality. And he was so worn out. He was limp, and the best description I can say, he was sort of like a fish that had been landed after a long struggle, and it was lying in the bottom of the boat, and that's what he seemed like. And when I saw that, I made my way into the circle and instinctively picked him up in my arms and started walking with him and telling him that, Dad, you've just come over from the other side. You're now in the world beyond death. And I began describing for him what was going to happen to him next. And I don't know how I knew this, but it was just a very instinctive thing. And I told him that his family was there and they were going to be coming for him and that he was going to be cared for. And after a while, one of the beings of light came to me and they said, thank you. You've done a great service, and we can take him now. His family's coming, and he's going to be fine. And so I gave my father up. And then when we came out of the experience, I was so overwhelmed and so moved by it because it was something that I couldn't have made up if I tried. Mm-hmm. It was so far beyond my experience that I was stunned, and I just wept because because it was so profound to think that I would have the privilege of being my father's side when he died, and that 7 years later I would have the privilege of welcoming him to the other side of death. It was almost more than I could begin to take in. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I just wept with tears of joy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very profound. There's a lot of concepts you talk about as you got into the Monroe Institute, and let's talk a little bit about some of them. You say God is a verb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that is really clear to me is that when we're talking about these kinds of mystical, otherworldly, spiritual experiences, our language fails us. Mm. It simply cannot capture it for several reasons. One is that our language is about the physical world, and so it doesn't really contain the vocabulary to convey these experiences that go beyond the physical. And secondly, I think it's their problem because we often grab on to the language and we think that somehow it does capture the reality when it doesn't. And so it creates kind of an illusion, and one of the big illusions is that our language is based on primarily on nouns, things. Mm-hmm. And it conveys a sense of the world as being a world that is made up of things. Excuse me. But the reality is that the world is always in flux, always changing. No matter what you look at, it is always in a state of transition. And so a much more accurate way of depicting the world and the world beyond would be with verbs. Everything is in that state of flux. And so from my perspective, when we look at a tree, rather than calling it a tree, we should probably be calling it tree-ing, mm-hmm. as if it is a verb. And I think that's certainly applicable to God as well. God is always in transition as the creator of this world, and experience of that divine essence is always in process and always in change. And that term, God is a verb, actually comes from a Jewish rabbi who wrote a wonderful book, and right now the name of the book is escaping me, but he's talking in that book about this ever-changing aspect of the divine essence, and it's something that has really stayed with me, and I think it's absolutely accurate. If we want to get a true understanding of the world, we have to look at it as something that is always in process, always changing, and that includes ourselves as well.
Mm-hmm. You say that intention is the key ingredient for focusing our energy.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues when you start to move into mystical experience is that there's so much there that's fascinating, and it's very easy to get distracted as we move into these different realms. Bob Monroe, who started his journey by having spontaneous out-of-body experiences, it wasn't something he was trying to do at all. It just happened to him. Was baffled by this aspect of how easy it is to get distracted once you move beyond the confines of the body. And he would do experiments where, you know, he was desperate to want to try to prove that this stuff was real and that he wasn't crazy. And one of the ways that he would try to do that is he would set up tasks for himself where he would go out and see if he could get information about something that he could later verify. But one of the things he kept running into was that when he would go out of body, he would forget what his task was because the world he was encountering was so fascinating. So he began to think that, you know, if this was going to have any utility for his daily life, he had to find a way of staying on task. And he realized over time that setting his intention before going into these experiences was one way to do that. And so he had a saying that intention is the vector of consciousness. In other words, you would go where you intended to go, or you would do what it was that you would intend to do. So one of the things that we do at the Institute is to help people to craft their intention before they go into their experience. Now, that intention can be that they simply want to see what they encounter. That can be one intention. But they may also have an intention of finding deeper meaning in a particular experience they've had, or maybe they have an intention of wanting to understand what a dream was about, or maybe they have a life issue that is confronting them that they want some kind of guidance on. And when we start to bring intention into that, then that helps to craft the experience in a more creative fashion. So it's simply a useful tool in working in these different dimensions.
I think it's a useful tool in working in life, but
absolutely.
I think, you know, quite often we don't set any intentions for the day, or we don't set intentions for, you know, our meal per se, and you know, we just let stress and life happen instead of being part of a conscious creation of it.
But absolutely, yeah. It's very easy, as you say, in daily life, to simply be distracted all the time. And so we don't have any intention to what we're doing. We're just moving through life as if we're numb, and our awareness is lacking almost totally. In fact, we're not even really present to the world. We're not really here. We think we're here, but we're just a ghost sort of moving through these strange experiences with no reflection, no awareness, no intention in what we're doing. And I think that's certainly one way to go through life, but there are also other ways to approach it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Let's talk about sex and spirituality.
Mm. Well, that's a big topic. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that we often forget is how that sexuality is something that is a function of our physical being. Going back again to Genesis, this separation between male and female is something that is part and parcel to our physical existence. Sexuality in non-physical worlds, metaphysical worlds, may be entirely different from what we experience here. I will tell you this one experience that happened to me while I was at the Monroe Institute, and it's not one that I've generally discussed on radio programs before, but here we go.
Here we go.
There was a woman in the group who apparently was interested in me for some reason. She was quite a bit older than I was, and I certainly didn't have much interest in it whatsoever. But she got pretty aggressive, not aggressive, but sort of forward and asking me about, you know, if I'd ever had an affair with a Latin woman, because she happened to be Latin in origin. And I said, no, I'm a happily married man. Thank you anyway, but I'm really not interested. Well, it just so happened after she was talking with me, and we went into another experience, and then all of a sudden, here I am in this metaphysical world, and her face just comes up right in front of me. And it was, I looked at her and I thought, well, this is crazy, you know, what in the world is she doing here? And I thought, well, what the heck, you know, we're out of body. Who knows what's going to happen? So I just sort of grabbed her, and in that moment, we came together in a spiritual sense in a way that was so shocking. Is probably the best way I can describe, because I was just being very playful at that point in time. And it was as if our beings came together, and there was this blast of energy, and it was instantaneous, so much so that I felt myself just careening off into space like a Roman candle. And it was like being on a roller coaster, but magnified, you know, 100, 1,000 times. And I didn't even know what had hit me. You know, it was just amazing. Well, after that, we went back. We went down to eat, and she came over to my table, and she says to me, "Did anything happen for you in that last experience?" And I said, "Well, yes, I did." And she said, "And what was that?" And I said, "Well, I guess we came together." And she looked at me, and she said, "I'll say we did." And then she just walked away. And, you know, it was one of those first indications for me that this stuff is pretty profound when two people can move into an experience in a non-physical way and have an interaction that both can recollect afterwards, and it can be a very, very profound thing. And in a sense, it had nothing to do with sexuality. It had everything to do with this coming together of energies. And so I think sometimes we have a tendency to want to take the human model of sexuality and somehow superimpose it upon the non-physical experience, but I'm not sure that they're transferable.
Right. And I think also we've judged our sexuality and sex, because a lot of times the major religions, you know, the leaders are supposed to be asexual or celibate.
Mm-hmm.
But it is really a powerful energy that can be also brought into the physical.
Yes, yes. And of course, you know, in my years of being a pastor, I certainly felt that very profoundly, you know, the sense of even though I was married and had 3 children, as far as I think some people were concerned, the only time I had sex was once each for those 3 children. And it, you know, it's not true. You know, we are sexual beings, and I think there is that sexual aspect that we carry within us. And yet, as far as I know, I don't know anyone who's come into this world who is not a product of sexuality. You know, it seems to be, last time I checked, it was the way that we are conceived.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, at some, because of our cultural awarenesses, we are led to try and believe that somehow if we're going to be spiritual, we have to be asexual. Or if we're going to be good, we have to be asexual. And so there's all this shame that surrounds us about sexuality, you know, original sin and all of that. And I think it's a misnomer. I don't think it does justice to who we are as human beings, and I don't think it does justice to our spirituality either. But you're right, it is a very, very powerful source. And I think I would love to see a day when we can begin to work more creatively with that sexual energy than we do today, because right now, for the most part, it's a source of great shame rather than being the entryway into something, profound states of awareness.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's probably one of our deepest wounds, because we're either obsessed with it or we repress it, and we repress it because we're obsessed with it, and
right,
and it just becomes
absolutely
a cycle of pain. Yeah. Okay, so let's move to, you know, this idea of creating the pristine world where, you know, we're trying to eradicate evil on the outside.
And did you want to say anything more about that? Or
Well, I think, you know, it seems that that's what we're always trying to do. We're trying to, you know, we're always looking outside of ourselves, and we're always trying to, you know, be in control and be in control of what's outside of us, and we're not moving inside.
Yeah, the real tragedy in that is that once we look at somebody and we can call them an enemy, then we feel justified in persecuting them in any way we want to. And, of course, that's where you have the beginning of not only separation, but the beginning of war and violence in the world. But the irony is that those outside of us are really carrying aspects of ourselves. And in a lot of ways, we don't realize that I think each of us has multiple personalities and that we have repressed along the way, and we try not to show anybody because, as we've said before, the shame that propels each of us. But when we are able to look upon the world as carrying aspects of ourselves, then we can do two things. One, we can begin to say, okay, that's inside of me. How can I work with that? And one of the real telltale signs is that somebody is carrying a repressed part of ourselves is if we get enraged by another person, or they really, really bend us out of shape, then we know that is the biggest indicator that person is really a mirror for us. And so that one of the things that we can do is to start to work with that in a creative way. So then our enemy becomes our greatest teacher. And in teaching us, so it gives us a much better look at who we are. Again, the perennial wisdom is know thyself. Mm-hmm. One of the great ways to know ourselves is to simply be aware of those people who make us angry and cause us rage. And when we do that, then I think we're in a much better position to begin to exercise compassion, not just to the people we like, but compassion to the people who we find it most difficult to like. And for me, that's the beginning of peace in the world. This whole work of compassion is absolutely essential if we're going to be able to move beyond the state of war that we seem to be so perpetually finding ourselves in.
Right. We end with tips for the spiritual hitchhiker. You know, one of the things you say is, you know, to trust our own uniqueness.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely important. And that's one of the most difficult things that we do at the Institute is to help people to stop comparing themselves to everyone else and begin to value the input, the wisdom, and the intelligence that is innate to them, and to be able to see that every person has been uniquely created for a particular purpose in this world. And when we do that, when people start to embrace their wonder, their mystery, and start to act on that, then they move more creatively into the calling of their hearts. And once we touch that, then our lives change pretty dramatically. And I think that's the greatest gift that we can give to ourselves is to really care for the uniqueness of our own creation.
Mm-hmm. To change ourself instead of trying to change the world?
Well, I think we actually change the world as we change ourselves.
Mm. Yes. Well, this has been a great pleasure. You are a delight to talk to. You have a wealth of knowledge that I think, you know, a lot of our listeners appreciate. And I think this is a great book to sort of, one, resonate with you because we've all had, you know, some experiences. We may not have had some of the profound spiritual experiences you've had, but it's a matter of, you know, understanding ourselves enough to know how to attain some of these experiences. And so I think, you know, the work that you're doing and the work that you're doing with Monroe Institute and in writing this book will assist a lot of people to, you know, connect in and understand how they're responsible. So I thank you.
Thank you, Lori. It's been a great pleasure to be with you.
Okay. And hopefully we'll have you back. We can chat about something else.
Sounds great.
All right.
Take care.
Have a great evening.